unspeakable depravity, a slave to her lusts. It was not such a great leap. Cupidity and concupiscence have the same Latin root. Having managed to evade her unblushing proposals, Herod took his offended sensibilities to his council. The woman's lewdness was an outrage. Herod's advisers begged him to reconsider. He was being rash. The risks were too great, as Cleopatra herself, closely guarded, well surrounded, and surely more astute about the political ramifications, surely knew. His counsel offered Herod a little lesson in the perverse dynamics of affection, one that might have come in handy later. In the first place, Antony would fail to appreciate Cleopatra's murder, even were its advantages pointed out to him. Second, his love would flame up the more fiercely if he thought that she had been taken from him by violence and treachery. He would emerge a man obsessed. Herod would be roundly condemned. He was, Herod's advisers emphasized, out of his league with this woman, the most influential of the day. Could he not bring himself to take the high road? Cleopatra was, of course, far too smart to seduce, or attempt to seduce, a small-time sovereign. She had nothing to gain by trapping Herod in such a way. It was unlikely that she would seduce a subordinate of her patron, especially improbable that she would fling herself into Herod's arms at a time when she was, by now quite visibly, it was nearly summer, pregnant with Antony's child. A Roman legion was stationed in Jerusalem to secure Herod's throne. Those men were unlikely to remain silent. Artful though he was, Herod had, as later events would reveal, a limited understanding of the human heart. With difficulty, his counsel dissuaded him from any assassination attempts. He would have no defense, the plot being against such a woman as was of the highest dignity of any of her sex at that time in the world. Herod could afford neither to offend Cleopatra, nor allow her any reason whatever to hate him. Surely he could bring himself to shrug off the dishonor her brazen advances had caused him. Footnote. The charge was a familiar one. In inciting a coup, Herod's son later condemned his aunt for having, one night, even forced her way into his chamber and, against his will, had immoral relations with him. End of footnote. Assuming these deliberations reached Cleopatra's ears, it is difficult not to hear her cackling with delight. She had, and knew she had, Antony's loyalty. She had better reason to consider disposing of Herod, who alone stood between her and full possession of the eastern coastline. As she well knew, his land had at several junctures belonged to the Ptolemies. In the end, Herod's counsel calmed him. Respectfully and politely, he escorted his visitor through the blazing heat of the Sinai to the Egyptian border. If Cleopatra knew of the discussions, and it is difficult to believe that she did not, theirs must have been a charged, tedious trip over molten sand. Surely it was so for the resentful Judean king. At Pelusium, he sent Cleopatra off, heavily pregnant and laden with gifts, a very different return than the furtive one she had made from that outpost in 48. Early in the fall, one blessed with a copious flood, she gave birth to her fourth child. In the ancient world, perhaps more than in any other, there was a good deal in a name. She called her new son Ptolemy Philadelphus, baldly evoking the glory days of the third century, the last time her family had reigned over as great an empire as did Cleopatra, the goddess, the younger, father-loving, and fatherland-loving, in 36. To Herod's chagrin, he was not so easily rid of this grasping, business-minded woman. During her stay at the Judean court, Cleopatra had made a few friends, to whom she was about to prove devilishly helpful. Shortly after the return to Egypt, she received word from Alexandra, Herod's mother-in-law. The Hasmonean princess had found in the Egyptian queen a sympathetic spirit, reason enough for Herod to have resented his royal visitor. He would condemn Cleopatra for having coolly eliminated most of her family. It was a rich accusation, coming from someone who had murdered his way to the throne and would continue his bloody spree for decades. But he had equal reason to envy her for having done so. For the most part, class and religious differences accounted for Herod and Alexandra's mutual antipathy. Not only was Herod Jewish on the wrong side, but the Idumeans were new converts to Judaism. The Jews had little use for them. Herod's wife and her family were, by contrast, noble-born descendants of generations of Jewish high priests, an office said to have originated with Moses' brother. In 37, Herod ventured outside that family to appoint a new high priest. He did so, although there was an obvious and immensely appealing candidate at hand, Mariam's 16-year-old brother, the tall, disarmingly attractive Aristobulus. Herod preferred an undistinguished official in the lucrative commanding office. Its trappings alone conferred a kind of otherworldly power. Fitted with a gold-embroidered diadem, the high priest ministered to his people in a floor-length tasseled blue robe, set with precious stones and hung with tinkling golden bells. Two brooches fixed a purple, scarlet, and blue cape, also studded with gems, upon his shoulders. Even on a lesser individual, the accessories were enough to make one feel that one had come into the presence of a man who belonged to a different world. In bypassing his young brother-in-law, Herod set off a maelstrom in his household. To Alexandra, daughter of a priest and widow of a prince, the appointment was an unendurable insult. With the help of a traveling musician, she smuggled word of the indignity to Cleopatra, on whom she felt she could count for female solidarity, especially royal female solidarity. She knew Cleopatra had little patience with Herod, and that she had Antony's ear. Could she not intercede with him, implored Alexandra, to obtain the high priesthood for her son? If Cleopatra did so, Antony appears to have had greater matters on his mind than the domestic affairs in Herod's household. He made no effort to intervene, although at some later date in 36, the double-jointed Dellius turned up in Jerusalem on unrelated business. Dellius had been the one to lure Cleopatra to Tarsus. The match of the conspiring mother-in-law and the contortionist advisor was almost too perfect. Alexandra's children were uncommonly handsome, to Dellius's eye, more the offspring of some god rather than of human beings. As ever, pulchritude sent his lively mind whirring. He persuaded Alexandra to have portraits painted of Mariam and Aristobulus and to submit them straight away to Antony. Were the Roman triumvir to set eyes upon them, promised Dellius, she would not be denied anything she might ask. Alexandra did as Dellius asked, which suggests either naivete on her part or something more toxic. She could be trusted to detect a plot from 100 paces away and to supply one, should none be brewing. If Josephus can be taken at his word, Dellius intended to recruit sexual partners of both genders for Antony. In receipt of the portraits, Antony hesitated, at least so far as Mariam was concerned. He knew Cleopatra would be furious. Josephus leaves unclear whether Cleopatra was likely to object on moral grounds or out of jealousy. She would in any event be slow to forgive. Evidently, Antony did not hesitate to send for Mariam's brother. Here Herod changed his mind. For his part, he deemed it unwise to send the most powerful Roman of his time, a striking 16-year-old boy, to use him for erotic purposes. Instead, Herod assembled his council and his family to complain of Alexandra's incessant complots. She colluded with Cleopatra to usurp his throne. She schemed to replace him with her son. He would do the right thing and appoint her son to the priesthood. Delius's proposition may obliquely have prompted the concession. Aristobulus's appointment would keep him in Judea, out of Antony's clutches, and far from Cleopatra's schemes. Alexandra responded with a flood of tears. She begged her son-in-law for forgiveness. She regretted her usual outspokenness, her heavy-handedness, doubtless an unhappy consequence of her rank. She was overcome with gratitude. Henceforth, she would be obedient in all ways. Aristobulus had barely donned the brilliant robes of the priesthood when Alexandra found herself under house arrest with round-the-clock surveillance. Herod continued to suspect his mother-in-law of treachery. Alexandra exploded with rage. She had no intention of living out her life in slavery and fear, and turned to the obvious address. To Cleopatra went a long-sustained lament about the state in which she found herself, and urging her to give her as much help as she possibly could. Again, taking a page from Euripides, "It is right for women to stand by a woman's cause," Cleopatra contrived an ingenious escape. She sent a ship to convey Alexandra and Aristobulus to safety. She would provide asylum for them both. It was now that, either on Cleopatra's counsel or her own initiative, Alexandra arranged for two coffins to be built. With her servant's assistance, she and Aristobulus climbed inside to be carried from Jerusalem to the coast, where Cleopatra's ship waited. Unfortunately, one of the servants betrayed Alexandra. As the fugitives were conveyed from the palace, Herod stepped from the darkness to surprise them. Though he yearned to do so, he did not dare punish Alexandra for fear of inciting Cleopatra. Instead, he made a great show of forgiveness while quietly vowing revenge. By October 35, Herod was at his wit's end with his wife and her family. His mother-in-law was in league with his greatest rival. With a far more legitimate claim to the throne, his brother-in-law commanded a dangerous degree of popular devotion. For Herod, the sight of the young man with his noble bearing and his impeccable good looks, in his majestic robes and golden headdress, presiding at the altar over the Sukkot festivities, was unbearable. In his subjects' affection for the high priest, he read a rebuke to his kingship. Meanwhile, Herod was undone in the intimacy of his home by his wife, whose hatred of him was as great as was his love of her. She manifested little of the lewdness Herod condemned in Cleopatra, and had taken to groaning aloud at his embrace. He could not retaliate, even indirectly, against his mother-in-law, too closely bound to Cleopatra. He could neutralize his overly promising brother-in-law, however. In the course of the unseasonably hot fall, Herod invited Aristobulus to join him at Jericho for a swim in the palace pool, nestled amid formal gardens. With friends and servants, the two roughhoused in the cool water at dusk. By nightfall, the 17-year-old Aristobulus had, amid the merrymaking, been held underwater a little too long. The high priest was dead. Grand shows of counterfeit emotion followed on both sides. Herod arranged for an expensive, incense-heavy funeral, shed abundant tears, and mourned loudly. Alexandra bore up bravely and quietly, the better to avenge her son's murder later. Only Mariam was candid. She denounced both her husband and his uncouth mother and sister. In no way deceived by Herod's account of the accident, Alexandra wrote again to Cleopatra, who commiserated with her. The loss was tragic and unnecessary. Alexandra could entrust the unseemly matter to her. She would take it up with Antony. On his return from Parthia, Cleopatra urged him to punish Aristobulus's murderer. Surely it was not right, she contended hotly, that Herod, who had been appointed by him as king of a country which he had no claim to rule, should have exhibited such lawlessness toward those who were the real kings. Hers was a petition in favor of proper convention, of knowing one's station, for the rights of sovereigns. Antony agreed she had a point. Herod's fears of Cleopatra's influence were well-founded. A summons arrived in due course from the Syrian coast. He was to explain himself to Antony. Having proceeded thus far by bribery and bravado, Herod was not generally cowed by authority. He tended rather to merry displays of presumption, and though he was said to have headed off timidly, he proved as adept at diffusing the situation as had Cleopatra 6 years earlier in Tarsus, which was another way of saying either that Mark Antony had no great gift for calling client kings to account, or that he was powerless in the presence of a master sycophant. The visit does reveal Antony to have been in no way putty in Cleopatra's hands. Herod arrived with lavish gifts and equally lavish explanations. He handily neutralized Cleopatra's arguments. Surely, Antony assured him, it was improper to demand an accounting of his reign from a king, since in that case he would not be a king at all, and those who had given a man this office and conferred authority upon him should permit him to exercise it. He purportedly said the same to Cleopatra, who would do well to concern herself less with Herod's affairs, or so Herod claimed, while boasting of the many honors Antony had shown him. The two dined together daily. Antony invited Herod to accompany him as he transacted business, and all this in spite of Cleopatra's bitter charges. There was nothing but goodwill between the two men. The Judean king reported that he was safe from that wicked woman and her insatiable greed. He was, on that count, slightly mistaken, although Herod did manage more or less to extricate himself from the feminine machinations at home. Within months of his return, his maniacally vindictive sister convinced him that her husband and Mariam had had an affair in his absence. It was a surefire way of dispensing both with a malignant sister-in-law and an unwanted husband. The claim was perfectly calibrated to fluster an unloved, besotted man. It worked the desired effect. As Euripides observed in a Hellenistic favorite among his plays, there seems to be some pleasure for women in sick talk of one another. Without so much as a hearing, Herod ordered his brother-in-law to be put to death, and for good measure he threw Alexandra into prison on the grounds that she must at least in some part be responsible for his troubles. Herod was someone whose loyalties could be bought, and who assumed the same of others. He was forever revising his will. Even without Alexandra's assistance, Cleopatra would continue to cause Herod headaches, or attempt to, for a few years longer. He was said to have fortified Masada out of fear of her, stockpiling grain, oil, dates, and wine in the fortress. He could not rest easy with the Egyptian queen in the neighborhood. Footnote. Another intrigue followed, involving Costobar, the governor of a neighboring region south of Judea. He owed his position to Herod, whom he disdained. Nor had Costobar any affection for the Jews. He preferred to restore polytheism to his people, and he knew precisely where he might appeal for relief. He wrote to Cleopatra, a clearinghouse for Antonian questions. His land had long belonged to her ancestors. Why did she not ask Antony for it? He himself, he swore, stood ready to transfer his loyalty to her. Costobar did so, not out of affection for Cleopatra, but distaste for Herod. He got nowhere, as Antony refused Cleopatra's request. Herod hesitated to take revenge on Costobar again for fear of Cleopatra. To forestall any future plots, Herod instead arranged for Costobar to marry his newly widowed sister, a death sentence of a kind. She would ultimately betray her second husband, as she had the first. End of footnote. And Herod's female relations continued to seethe with hatred for his wife. They easily convinced him that Mariam had in the end secretly sent her portrait to Antony. Herod had a ready ear only for slander and inclined always toward those who indulged it. He liked to be proved right in his dire delusions. The accusation struck him like a thunderbolt and caused him to obsess anew about Cleopatra's deadly schemes. Footnote. His sister would not be happy until she had wrought vengeance as well on Herod and Mariam's sons, whom Herod later murdered. They were buried alongside Aristobulus. End of footnote. Surely this was her doing. He was menaced, he reckoned, with the loss not merely of his consort, but of his life. He sentenced his wife to death. As she was led to her execution, her mother leapt out at her to scream and pull at her hair. She was, Alexandra berated her daughter, an evil, insolent woman, insufficiently grateful to Herod, and entirely deserving of her fate. Mariam walked serenely past, without acknowledging her mother. She was 28. In an additional proto-Shakespearean twist, Herod was undone by her death. His desire for Mariam only increased. He convinced himself that she was still alive. He was physically incapacitated. He suffered precisely as his advisers had predicted Antony would if deprived of Cleopatra. Ultimately, Herod left Jerusalem on an extended recuperative hunting trip. Alexandra hatched a few new conspiracies in his absence. He ordered her execution on his return. Throughout 36, Mark Antony reported on his dazzling success in Parthia to Rome. The city held festivals and performed sacrifices in his honor. Cleopatra's intelligence may have been better. She was well over 1,000 miles from the snowy theater of action, but closer than was the Italian peninsula. She was every bit as invested in Antony's victory. She had the resources to arrange for regular emissaries. Nonetheless, she may have been surprised by the messenger who arrived in Alexandria late in the year. He had an urgent summons, unlike any she had previously received. Probably a month in coming, it brought a season of exhilarations to an end. Antony and his army had returned from their Parthian adventure. It had taken them nearly to the Caspian Sea, in what is today northern Iran. Theirs had been a mere jaunt compared to Alexander the Great's, but they had made an 1,800-mile trek all the same. They camped now in a small village south of modern-day Beirut, with an excellent harbor in which Cleopatra could land without difficulty. Antony implored her to join him post-haste and to bring with her substantial gold, provisions, and clothing for his men. She had by no means expected to see him so soon. Parthia could hardly have been conquered in a matter of months. Caesar had anticipated a campaign of at least 3 years. Plutarch reports that Cleopatra was slow in coming, but it is unclear whether she actually delayed or if it only seemed as if she did to Mark Antony, for whom she could not arrive quickly enough. It was winter. Heavy rains and gale winds lashed the Mediterranean. She had supplies to assemble and a fleet to prepare. She needed either to collect or mint silver denarii. She had given birth months earlier. She knew she was heading toward disturbing news. For his part, Antony was restless and agitated, though Plutarch may have erred in imputing cause and effect, alleging that Antony was beside himself because Cleopatra was dilatory. The purported delay had little to do with the authentic distress. Antony attempted to distract himself by drinking heavily. Already it was acknowledged that there is no other medicine for misery, but was without the patience to sit through a meal. He interrupted each one to run to shore, where he scanned the horizon again and again for Egyptian sails, irregular behavior in a precise and precisely disciplined Roman camp, where everyone dined together. Plutarch accuses Cleopatra of having dawdled, but the point is that she came in a season of short days and long nights with the requested items, probably arriving soon after Antony's 48th birthday. She delivered an abundance of clothing and money. Both Plutarch and Dio retail a disgruntled rumor. Some claimed that she brought clothing and supplies, but that Antony settled his own gold on his men, passing the monies off as a gift from Cleopatra, who had little patience for his Parthian obsession. Either way, he was buying goodwill toward Egypt, clearly a priority for him, and at a time when he could ill afford to do so. Slow-moving Egyptian queens aside, Antony had every reason for despair. There had been no dazzling success in Parthia, only a demoralizing campaign followed by a disastrous retreat. From the start, he had made strategic mistakes. Given the size of his army and the length of their march, he had left his siege equipment behind. He could not always find the Parthians, but they could always find him. Swarms of talented archers and pikemen repeatedly ambushed the regular Roman rows. Antony had relied on the Armenians, Parthia's western neighbor, for military aid. They had not proved the faithful allies he anticipated. Not for the first time, they lured the Romans into a yawning and abysmal desert, only to abandon them. No battle had been as costly as the retreat. Having marched for 30 miles in darkness, Antony's exhausted men threw themselves upon brackish water. Starving, they feasted on poisonous plants that made them stagger and vomit. Convulsions, dysentery, and delusions followed. What stagnant water and poisonous plants failed to claim, the heat in Armenia and the unending snows of Cappadocia did. Ice congealed on beards, toes and fingers froze. By the time he reached the Syrian coast, by the time he had begun obsessively to scan the horizon for Cleopatra, Antony had lost nearly a third of his splendid army and half his cavalry. In 18 modest battles, he had secured few substantial victories. In his catastrophic retreat, he lost some 24,000 men. In something of a backhanded compliment, Cleopatra would be assigned blame for his Parthian missteps. For so eager was he to spend the winter with her that he began the war before the proper time and managed everything confusedly. He was not master of his own faculties, but as if he were under the influence of certain drugs or of magic rites, was ever looking eagerly towards her, and thinking more of his speedy return than of conquering the enemy, Plutarch explains. Yet again, Cleopatra was said to have thrown off Antony's timing. Or yet again, Antony fumbled, and Cleopatra wound up with the blame. The campaign proved as revealing as it was disastrous. Repeatedly, Antony found himself outwitted by a cunning enemy, deceived by friends. The Parthian months were less about loving the wrong woman than trusting the wrong men. Antony was a compassionate general, so much sharing in the toils and distresses of the unfortunate and bestowing upon them whatever they wanted, as to elicit more loyalty from the wounded than the able. He seemed sorely deficient in the vengeance department. The Armenian king, Artavasdes, had encouraged Antony to invade neighboring Media, modern Azerbaijan, a land of fierce tribes and towering mountain ranges, then double-crossed him. His men encouraged him to call Artavasdes to account, which Antony refused to do. He neither reproached him with his treachery, nor abated the friendliness and respect usually shown to him. He knew how to play on the heartstrings. When he needed to rally his men against dismal odds, he called for a dark robe that he might be more pitiful in their eyes. Friends dissuaded him. Antony made the appeal to his troops in the purple robe of a Roman general. The greatest casualty of the expedition was, arguably, his peace of mind. At least once he was on the brink of suicide. He was badly shaken, as only a commander who in the past had proved resourceful, valorous, omnipresent, could be. Worse yet, after the wretched expedition, having lost tens of thousands of his men, distributed what remained of his treasure, and begged to be put to death, he convinced himself in Syria by an extraordinary perversion of mind that by escaping as he had actually won the day. Such was the exhausted, distraught man Cleopatra found on the Syrian coast. Despite the charges that she had shortchanged him, her arrival brought relief to his hungry troops, demoralized and in tatters. She very much played the bountiful, beneficent Isis. Of how she handled delusional Antony, we have no clue. She must have been taken aback by what 9 months had done to a well-drilled, superbly supplied army. From the start, there were irritations and tense differences of opinion in the Syrian camp. It was at this time that Cleopatra urged Antony to punish Herod for his mistreatment of Alexandra, and that Antony instructed Cleopatra not to meddle, a message she was unaccustomed to hearing. Under the circumstances, it would have struck her as particularly undeserved. She remained with Antony for several weeks at the center of the regularly spaced tents, the improvised Roman city, as he pondered his next steps. Word had reached him that the Median and Parthian kings had quarreled in the wake of his retreat, and that the Median king, whose lands abutted Parthia, now proposed to join forces with Antony. Revived by the news, he began to prepare a fresh campaign. Cleopatra was not the only woman to come to Antony's rescue. He had, too, a very loyal wife. She applied for permission to fly to her husband's aid, permission her brother cheerfully granted. Octavian could well afford to send supplies. His own campaigns had gone well, and Octavia's trip was essentially an ambush. In 37, Octavian had promised Antony 20,000 men for Parthia, which he had not delivered. With his sister, he now sent an elite corps of 2,000 hand-picked, sumptuously armored bodyguards. For Antony to accept them was to forfeit 18,000 men at a time when he desperately needed to replenish the ranks. To decline was to insult his rival's sister. For Octavian, eager for a plausible excuse for a breach, it was an irresistible opportunity. Antony could not do the right thing. Octavia hastened to Athens, sending word ahead to her husband. Dio has Antony in Alexandria at this time, while Plutarch implies that he and Cleopatra remained on the Syrian coast. Two things are certain. Antony and Cleopatra were at this juncture very much together, and Antony held Octavia off. She was to come no farther. He was set to depart again for Parthia. In no way fooled by his message, Octavia sent a personal friend of Antony's to pursue the matter and to remind Antony of his wife's many virtues. "What," asked the envoy, loyal to both husband and wife, "was Octavia to do with the goods she had with her?" Here she came close to showing up Cleopatra, which may have been the point. Octavia had in hand not only the richly equipped Praetorian guards, but a vast quantity of clothing, horses and pack animals, money of her own, and gifts for Antony and his officers. Where was she to send them? She was throwing down the gauntlet, to which Cleopatra responded, though not in kind. In Octavia, she recognized a serious rival, alarmingly close at hand. Her loyal representative was on Cleopatra's territory. Cleopatra had heard reports of Octavia's beauty. Roman men could be catty, too. Those who had set eyes on her would later wonder aloud about Antony's preference for the Egyptian queen. Neither in youthfulness nor beauty, they concluded, was she superior to Octavia. The two women were, in fact, the same age. Cleopatra worried that Octavia's authority, her brother's influence, her pleasurable society, and her assiduous attentions to Antony would make Octavia irresistible. The sovereign who had proceeded by bold maneuver and steely calculation here attempted, or was said to attempt, a different tack, resorting to loud, choking sobs, depending on the occasion, the first or last weapon in a woman's arsenal. Plutarch sniffs that Cleopatra pretended to be desperately in love with Antony. In a Roman account, she cannot even secure credit for an authentic emotional attachment. If his report can be believed, it reads a little like a cartoon frame spliced into a nuanced narrative. She was as effective a woman as she was a sovereign. She could have offered Fulvia a very valuable tutorial. Cleopatra neither begged nor bargained. She did not raise her voice. Instead, she swore off food. She appeared languid with love, undone by her passion for Antony. Already the hunger strike was the oldest trick in the book. Euripides' Medea, too, waged one to win back a wayward husband. Cleopatra affected a look of rapture when Antony drew near, and one of faintness and melancholy when he went away. She dragged herself about, dissolved in tears, which she made a great show of drying whenever Antony turned up. She meant, of course, to spare him any distress. Cleopatra rarely did anything alone, and for her wail and whimper act, recruited a supporting cast. Her courtiers worked overtime on her behalf. Mostly they upbraided Antony. How could he be so heartless as to destroy a mistress who was devoted to him and him alone? Did he not grasp the difference between the two women? For Octavia, they said, had married him as a matter of public policy and for the sake of her brother, and enjoyed the name of wedded wife. She hardly bore comparison to Cleopatra, who, although a sovereign, the queen of millions, was called Antony's mistress, and she did not shun this name nor disdain it, as long as she could see him and live with him. Hers was the noblest of sacrifices. She was neglecting a great kingdom and her many responsibilities, wearing her life away as she follows with you on your marches in the guise of a concubine. How could he remain indifferent? There was no contest between the two women. Cleopatra would forsake all as long as she could see him and live with him. But if she were driven away from him, she would not survive it, a conclusion she effectively supported with her shuddering gasps and inanition. Even Mark Antony's closest friends chimed in, enthralled by Cleopatra, and doubtless well aware of Antony's leanings. As campaigns went, this one involved skirmishes, if not outright battles. The atmosphere around Antony and Cleopatra was highly charged. The tactics also proved highly effective. Cleopatra's theatrics melted Antony. The reproofs of his friends flattered him. A man of disorderly passions, Antony seemed to count on chiding, to which he gamely responded. He was a happy subordinate, arguably at his best in that role. Plutarch has him taking more pleasure in the rebukes than he did in any commendations. Scolded for his hard-heartedness, he failed to see that by this seeming admonition he was being perversely drawn towards her. He convinced himself that she would kill herself were he to leave her. It was particularly difficult for him to be angry under the circumstances. He had already the death of one loyal, intelligent woman on his conscience. Whatever else could be said of Antony, he was compassionate, as any of his men could attest. He rebuffed Octavia. She returned to Rome, a woman scorned in all eyes but her own. She refused to dwell on the insult. When her brother ordered her to leave the marital home, she refused to do so. Again, she renounced the Helen of Troy role, claiming that it was an infamous thing even to have it said that the two greatest commanders in the world plunged the Romans into civil war, the one out of passion for, and the other out of resentment in behalf of, a woman. Cleopatra showed no such disinclination. With Antony's affections went the throne of Egypt. To lose him to Octavia was to lose everything. Hers was a virtuoso performance that yielded enduring results. From this point on, the two were inseparable, for which Dio credits the passion and witchery of Cleopatra, and Plutarch, certain drugs or magic rites. Antony's men and Octavia instead acknowledge a very real affection. Geography suggests as much as well. Antony remained with Cleopatra in Alexandria for the winter. He had a sliver of a practical reason to do so, as he intended to march east again come spring. As of the winter of 35, it is impossible to deny a full-blooded romance, if by romance we mean a congenial, intimate past, a shared family, a shared bed, and a shared vision of the future. Cleopatra's blue-ribbon rendition of the lovesick female distracted Antony from a second Parthian offensive, which he postponed to be at her side. She was thin and pale. Her state of mind worried him. In 35, she did very intentionally throw off his timing. An Eastern triumph remained as critical for Antony as ever, if not more so. While he licked his Parthian wounds, Octavian had been piling up successes. He had crushed Sextus Pompey and sidelined Lepidus. With bribes, Octavian also lured Lepidus's 18 legions out from under him. Only Antony and Octavian remained, and only an Eastern victory could once and for all secure Caesar's glorious mantle. Antony had unfinished business as well with the Armenian king, who he belatedly decided should be held accountable for the catastrophic outing. Cleopatra has been assumed not to have smiled on Antony's military ambitions and to have preferred his attentions directed elsewhere. Certainly, Parthia was of less concern to her than were Roman politics. Egypt was, for the most part, insulated against an Eastern invasion. At the same time, that kingdom was entirely vulnerable to Rome. Military glory was by no means the coin of her realm. A Parthian expedition would have struck her as futile on many counts. It is easy to hear how the argument might have gone, important to remember it, a matter of speculation. What would have made eminent good sense for Antony was a return to Rome, from which he had been absent for 5 years. That outing, Cleopatra must have resisted with every fiber of her theatrical being. An Eastern expedition was expensive, but by her calculation, a trip to Rome, a return to Octavia and Octavian, would have been infinitely more costly. Antony remained sorely in need of a victory. He was also eager to settle a score. In his endeavor to take vengeance on the Armenian king with the least trouble to himself, he sent the ever-inventive Dellius east to Armenia. As usual, Dellius had a proposition. It this time amounted to the traditional diplomatic bandage. Would Artavasdes, the Armenian monarch, not like to promise his daughter to Cleopatra and Antony's 6-year-old son, Alexander Helios? Cleopatra presumably signed off on this appeal, which would have established a Ptolemy on the Armenian throne. It would also have secured a peaceful alliance with a mountain kingdom crucial to a Parthian invasion and divided in its loyalties. Several times a Roman ally, Armenia was in both sympathy and civilization Parthian. The offer evidently made less sense to Artavasdes, a subtle and unflinching statesman. He resisted Delius's blandishments and his bribes. Antony countered in the spring by invading Armenia. In little time, he subdued the country, declaring it a Roman province. This was vengeance more than victory. Armenia was a strategically located buffer state, but by no means a great power. And Antony knew the conquest satisfied his men, who had for months howled that Artavasdes had cost them Parthia. In anticipation of a larger campaign, Antony left the bulk of his army in the east for the winter. He returned to Alexandria in triumph, taking with him not only the collected treasure of Armenia, but its king, his wife, their children, and the provincial governors. Out of deference to their rank, he bound the royal family in chains of gold. This time, Cleopatra received a jubilant message from her lover. She issued orders for an extravagant ceremony to mark his return. She likely took her cues from Antony. Her immediate family were not conquerors. Processions were, however, a Ptolemaic specialty. The sphinx-lined avenues of Alexandria were designed for them, and the Roman triumph derived from them. That of autumn 34 was sensational. Antony sent his captives ahead of him into the city, which he entered in his purple cloak aboard a chariot. Presumably, they paraded past the marble colonnades and the awnings of shuttered shops along the canopic way, lined with vibrant banners and cheering spectators. Here was the kind of show at which Ptolemies excelled. To this one, Antony and Cleopatra added a new twist. As he marched his booty and captives into the heart of the city, Antony presented them to the Queen of Egypt in ceremonial attire on a lofty golden throne atop a silver-plated platform amid her adoring subjects. Antony had long been good at paying homage to his mistresses. Cleopatra received not only the spoils of his campaign, the royal treasury and its officials, but the proud Armenian king and his family in their golden fetters. A discordant note was struck when the fresh-faced Artavasdes arrived before her. The Armenian king was neither a fool nor a Philistine. He wrote histories and intricate speeches. For years, he had shrewdly played Parthia and Rome off against each other. True to tenacious form, he approached, but would neither sink to his knees before her nor acknowledge her rank. Instead, he addressed her by name. All coercion was futile. Though treated harshly, no member of the Armenian royal family would prostrate himself before the Queen of Egypt. It is notable that, despite the misbehavior, Artavasdes survived the display. In Rome, a captive king was rarely so lucky, no matter how well he behaved. It was Cleopatra's first experience of a royal humiliation and a monarch's proud resistance. There was every reason why they should have made an impression. A lavish banquet for the people of Alexandria followed, with celebrations at the palace and with public entertainments. She distributed coins and food freely. The military-themed procession was an oddity to the Alexandrians, though it had at least Ptolemaic roots. There was no precedent for the splendid ceremony that followed. Several days later, a throng filled Alexandria's colonnaded gymnasium, west of the city's main crossroads, minutes from the palace. 600 feet long, the city's largest structure, the gymnasium stood at the center of Alexandria, as at the center of its intellectual and recreational life. It was the opera hall of its day. A gymnasium's presence was what made a town a city. In the open court of the complex that fall day, the Alexandrians discovered another silver platform on which stood two massive golden thrones. Mark Antony occupied one. Addressing her as the new Isis, he invited Cleopatra to join him on the other. She appeared in the full regalia of that goddess, a pleated, lustrously striped chiton, its fringed edge reaching to her ankles. On her head, she may have worn a traditional tripartite crown, or one of cobras with a vulture cap. By one account, Antony dressed as Dionysus, in a gold-embroidered gown and high Greek boots. In his hand, he held the god's fennel stalk. An ivy wreath circled his head. It seemed a second act of the exultant play begun in Tarsus, when, as Cleopatra made her way upriver, word preceded her that Venus had arrived to revel with Dionysus for the happiness of Asia. Cleopatra's children occupied four smaller thrones at the couple's feet. In his husky voice, Antony addressed the assembled multitude. By his command, Cleopatra was henceforth to be known as Queen of Kings. On coins, she was Queen of Kings whose sons are kings. The titles would change with the territory, so that an Upper Egypt stela of 4 years later has her as Mother of Kings, Queen of Kings, the youngest goddess. As for her consort, 13-year-old Caesarion, Antony promoted him to King of Kings, a pointed recycling of an Armenian and Parthian title. Antony conferred these honorifics in the name of Julius Caesar, Cleopatra's husband and Caesarion's father, an unusual case of flaunting a lover's prior sexual history. Also on Caesar's behalf, Antony proceeded to name his sons with Cleopatra as King of Kings. Producing the boys in turn, he assigned vast territories to each. The Eastern-inflected names came in handy now. At his cue, little Alexander Helios stepped forward in the loose leggings and caped tunic of a Persian monarch. On his head, he wore an upright, pointed turban topped with a peacock feather. His territory stretched to India. He was to rule over Armenia, Media, and, once his father had conquered it, Parthia. He was again promised in marriage, this time to the daughter of the Median king, Artavasdes' traditional enemy. 2-year-old Ptolemy Philadelphus, the fruit of Antony and Cleopatra's Antioch reunion, was an Alexander the Great in miniature. He wore the high boots, the short purple cloak, and the brimmed woolen hat, in this case wrapped with a diadem, of a Macedonian. To him went Phoenicia, Syria, and Cilicia, the lands west of the Euphrates. Cleopatra Selene was to preside over Cyrene, the Greek settlement in what is today eastern Libya, hundreds of miles across the desert. The distributions made, each of the two younger boys rose to kiss his parents. They were then surrounded by a colorful phalanx of bodyguards, Armenians in Alexander's case, Macedonians in Ptolemy's. In such a way, Antony parceled out the East, including lands not yet in his possession. For the young woman who 14 years earlier had smuggled herself into Alexandria to plead for her diminished kingdom, it was a sensational reversal. Cleopatra stood divine and indomitable, less queen than empress, the supreme Roman commander at her side. Her rule extended over a vast swath of Asia, its frontiers established and now at peace. She was protected by Roman legions. With her children, she now reigned, at least nominally, over more land than had any Ptolemy in centuries. On coins minted for the occasion, with them she became the first foreigner to appear on a Roman coin, she appears majestic, authoritative. She has also aged. Her mouth is fuller, and she is noticeably fleshier, especially around the neck. It is impossible to say whose ambition had brought about the sparkling ceremony, to be known later as the Donations of Alexandria. It is especially difficult to locate Cleopatra's fingerprints. The truth is smudged forever by Roman manhandling. At least in part, the message of the day was clear. On their golden thrones sat what even a cool-headed modern historian has reasonably called the two most magnificent people in the world. Together they seemed to resurrect, if not expand upon, the dream of Alexander the Great, promoting a universal empire, one that transcended national boundaries and embraced a common culture that reconciled Europe and Asia. They announced a new order. Cleopatra presided over the ceremony and the citywide banqueting that followed, not only as a sovereign, but as a deity after all, with the divine Caesar's son on one side, Dionysian Antony on the other. Old prophecies evidently resurfaced now. The Jews linked Cleopatra's rule with a golden age and with the coming of the Messiah. The Queen of Egypt answered the call for an Eastern savior. She would rise above Rome for a better world. In conflating the political and the religious, the imagery was all on Cleopatra's side. Mark Antony had a habit of jumping to conclusions, and in many ways, the donations were an exercise in wishful thinking. Certainly, they made no difference to the administration of the lands in question, many of them governed by Roman proconsuls. The Armenian king was still very much alive. Parthia was not Antony's to distribute. A 2-year-old child was in no position to rule. As much as the ceremony was a stunning act of assimilation and appropriation, entirely Ptolemaic in its gigantism, it was probably not intended solely for the Alexandrians. Pageantry was never lost on them, but by 34, Cleopatra's subjects needed no confirmation of her steady rule, of her divinity, her supremacy, or even of Antony's role in her court. They knew him already more as Dionysus than as Roman magistrate. The two may have intended to formalize arrangements for a subdued but still messy East. Antony may have meant only to rebuke those monarchs who had defied him in Parthia. Or Antony and Cleopatra may have been delivering a powerful, unsubtle message to Octavian. His power derived solely from Julius Caesar. He might well be Caesar's adopted son, but Caesar's natural son was, Antony and Cleopatra emphasized, very much alive, nearly adult, and suddenly sovereign over a vast expanse of territory. That message was particularly crucial at a time when Octavian was said to be busy behind the scenes undermining Antony's efforts in Armenia, where he attempted to suborn Artavasdes. Even if Antony and Cleopatra were not broadcasting to Rome, it is from Rome that our accounts derive. It is impossible to disentangle what the two may have meant to convey, what Rome actually heard, and what the propagandists turned out, magnified and distorted. The language of the display was Eastern. Especially in 34, it translated poorly. Antony should have known better than to emphasize Caesarion's paternity. He may well have known better. Plutarch does not mention the inflammatory remarks. Octavian had reason to play up the insult, as he did the un-Roman magnificence. It was incumbent on him to blunt the potent symbolism, to turn a military triumph and royal pageant into a drunken revel and a specious, silly costume drama. One did not pay tribute to Julius Caesar in Alexandria, after all. Nor did one celebrate a triumph outside Rome, far from the Roman gods. And why this riotous celebration of an Armenian victory, when Parthia remained to be punished? Whatever his message, Antony meant the donations as an official act. He sent reports of the triumph and the ceremony back to Rome for Senate ratification. Devoted friends intervened, aware that his dispatches would be read in an unflattering light. Antony appeared theatrical and arrogant, precisely the crimes that had cost Caesar his life. If he intended to dazzle his compatriots with the gorgeous display, the laws of optics worked differently from what he had remembered. Rome had to shield her eyes from the glare of golden thrones. Definitions were less fluid in that city, where Antony's dual role as commander in the West and monarch in the East taxed the orderly Roman mind. He dangerously mixed his metaphors. If Cleopatra were the queen of those territories, what role was the Roman commander to play? Antony had, after all, claimed no territories for himself. Cleopatra's title was preposterously, objectionably large, an insult not only to Rome, but to her fellow sovereigns. She had long occupied an exceptional position in the Roman constellation of client kings. She now outranked them in both wealth and influence. And Antony and Cleopatra's relationship was problematic. What was a foreign woman doing on a Roman coin? It did not help that Antony shared denarii with a woman not his wife. He appeared to be distributing Roman lands to a foreigner. Only one man wanted Antony's dispatches published. Octavian did not succeed,